This is The Fall of Steve Martinez, from IRS employee to convicted con artist. It's that time of year again to shine a spotlight on the most nefarious tax offender, and the 2012 Tax Offender of the Year Award is not just for those who evade taxes, it's for those who have committed heinous and criminal acts, displaying a true level of greed, deception, and utter disregard for the law. So get ready to be stunned by the incredible true story of Steve Martinez, an IRS agent turned con artist who was willing to do anything to keep his secrets safe, even murder. The Martinez fraud case is one that is multi-layered and full of shocking twists and turns. Join us on today's episode as we get into the mind of a fraudster. From trusted tax professional to criminal mastermind, the unbelievable true story of Steve Martinez's double life as a con artist and his desperate attempts to silence those who stood in his way. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tax Crime Junkies, a podcast about true tax crimes. I'm your host, Dom, and with me is my lovable and dapper co-host, Tom. You can't tell, but Tom is one of the best-dressed tax guys I know.
Thanks, Dom, but I'm not really sure the bar is high in our profession, unfortunately. Dominique and I are tax crime junkies, and each week we bring to you true tax crimes and financial scandals. If you're a tax planner, tax professional, or even just interested in the financial world, this is the right place to learn the inner details of prosecutions related to the U.S. tax laws.
So, Tom, what are we talking about today?
Great question. We're going to call this The Fall of Steve Martinez, from IRS agent to convicted con artist.
Okay, go on.
The official world of trouble for Steven Martinez began in 2011. When there was an arrest warrant taken out against him. Now, it didn't start then, of course. Steven Martinez was actually a former IRS agent and a certified public accountant in California with his own firm, where he was engaged in a scheme defrauding his taxpayer clients by preparing actual returns for the clients, while at the same time filing a set of false tax returns with the IRS. Now, Steve was being clever. He created a dummy business called EFTPS and took his clients' tax payment checks right home to the bank. So rather than forwarding his tax payments from his clients to the IRS, he took the money and pocketed it while living lavishly off of the spoils. While still getting paid for his services, Steve was about to pull this off for a number of years before he got caught.
So this is the old, just make your check payable to the EFTPS and it'll satisfy the IRS while you go out the back door with people's payments. That's the scam there. I mean, wouldn't the IRS catch on in about 30 days when the funds were never received, though?
Well, you would think, but remember, he filed fraudulent returns with the IRS. So those fraudulent returns, the ones actually filed, showed less tax owed.
Yowza. So not only was he then taking his clients' tax payments for himself, but at the same time, he's also committing tax fraud by filing phony tax returns. Two for one.
Exactly. You got it. Now, who knows what he told people the company EFTPS actually represented? Maybe everyone to fool the payment system. But basically, Martinez presented real tax returns showing real liabilities to his clients, which he then had them write checks for to be submitted by Mr. Martinez, the oh-so-helpful CPA who happily handled it on their behalf. Mm-hmm. Then he fraudulently report a lot less income on a bogus set of tax returns, leaving the taxpayer's account balance at a nice, even zero tax due. Bam! The clients think they've paid up. The IRS thinks the clients are paid up. And no one's the wiser that Martinez is making way more money from this embezzling scheme than he ever could just preparing returns. He used this money to sponsor his lifestyle, totaling almost $11 million, spent most of it on a boat, expensive home renovations, luxury wear, and a beach home in Mexico. Now, he actually kept copies of not only the real returns, but also the fake phony returns, and ultimately, that may have been his undoing, but it could only go so far. When a client suspected and then went to report him to the authorities, that's when it went downhill.
I'll say, so maybe this is a circumstance where being organized and keeping everything is not very smart. And I think this is the start of a double life for Steve Martinez, Tom. Here you have this 51-year-old, and he's considered to be a brilliant accountant. He comes from the IRS. He has the respect of his colleagues, his family, his friends. He's said to be a family man, a Christian, a helper. Where have we heard this stuff before?
Exactly.
A man given to random acts of kindness and a giver of those with special needs. He's got a family. He's married to his wife, Cynthia. He's got three kids. At this time, he had a girl and two boys, 11, 8, and 6. And here's what the assistant U.S. attorney, Joseph Orbona, had to say about why Stephen did this.
He kind of wanted to emulate his wealthy clients. He wanted to live the lavish lifestyle that they lived. He wanted to kind of be like them, so to speak.
And we all know what other crimes he committed by default, right, Tom? He failed to report his illegally gotten gains on his own tax returns. So now he's personally committing tax evasion. You know, he's evading his clients' taxes. They're completely unaware. But he's also tax evading himself because he's not fully reporting all of his income, even the illegally gotten income. And so when the investigation started, he was found to have failed to report more than $15.8 million, and he was arrested on the grounds of alleged assorted tax and related offenses. You know, wow. The white-collar crimes that we talk about. So get this. Steve begins to catch on. He realizes that investigators are checking into his practice, and he's decided at that moment to go deeper to cover his tracks. So in 2009, listen to what he did. This guy is really smart. He started amending his own returns, and he started reporting additional income, thereby sidestepping the tax evasion on his own taxes. But he did it in a really strange way.
Well, I don't know if he's actually fixing the problem, but how did he do it?
Based on IRS records, he reported additional income, and he listed it as other income. You know, we would call that our old line 21 income, right?
Right.
But then he also claimed a miscellaneous deduction in the exact same amount. So it's like he's trying to technically meet the requirements that, yes, he in fact reported the extra income, but then he takes it right back off so that it's a wash.
So for many reasons, that's not going to make him beat the evasion charge, period, end of story.
Yeah, it definitely didn't work.
Wow.
Check this out. He added notes on the amended returns that said, and this I'm taking this right from the returns, inclusion of additional income, form 1040, line 21. I am including an additional $200,000 into my gross receipts. I did not earn or receive this amount. I am including this amount into my gross receipts to ensure complete and absolute compliance with IRC 61. I mean, this is laughable. I want to ensure that I have not understated my gross income. I want to ensure that any assertion to the contrary is not sustained. It's like he's coming out and saying, I know you guys are going to accuse me of tax evasion, and you, that's not possible because here I'm telling you. And then it says Form A, you know, Honest Form A. This is, you know, pre-TCJA. So we had other deductions. And he wrote, I'm deducting an additional $200,000 on Form Schedule A to ensure that I have deducted all deductions that I am entitled to take.
Now, Dominique, when he signed that amended return, you know what he was really signing was his arrest warrant, frankly.
Yeah.
He basically admitted the invasion when he filed that return.
Yeah.
That's strange, being a former revenue agent. He didn't understand exactly what he was doing in this Hail Mary attempt to fix a situation. But, you know, let's talk timeline. When did he work at the IRS as a revenue agent?
So he was an IRS agent between the years of 1988 and 1992. So not a huge amount of time. He became a CPA in 1994, and he started a tax preparation business in 1998. I don't know what he was doing between 94 and 98, but from the court proceedings, it appears that starting in 2005 is when Martinez began this scheme of keeping clients' tax payments for himself while submitting false lower tax returns to the government on behalf of his clients, and that's to keep the IRS from saying, hey, where are these tax payments, right? But I have to say, Tom, here's when he started amending his own returns. He amended starting in 2003. So perhaps he was underreporting his own income before he started stealing the tax payments.
Absolutely. I mean, his crimes probably started small and then escalated from there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think you go out the gate stealing $15 million.
No.
It looks like, though, between 2004 and 2011 is the primary time he committed these financial crimes, according to the government. And by 2009, he was under investigation for fraud, and that's when he filed those amended tax returns for himself. So he gets wind, you know, that people are nosing around and inspecting what's going on. Then he goes and he hires attorneys. And he hired his attorneys in 2010. He allowed them to put a lien on his home as a retainer. So I guess, you know, that's the advice I always hear, Tom, is when you're a criminal defense attorney, get paid up front.
Right. Except when your home may have been paid for with legally procured money, right? I mean,
yeah.
Lien. There's a lot of questions. The tax lien could even have precedence over the attorney's lien. So I don't know if the attorneys got paid. I hope they did. They definitely earned their keep with Mr. Martinez. But let's go over some specific examples of how he committed these crimes. We'll take a taxpayer called CII. In 2006, Martinez prepared and presented to his client CII an S-corporation tax return showing about $12.2 million in income. Now, he used the Schedule K-1, which shows the pass-through income from the S-corporation, to then prepare the taxpayer's Form 1040, where he'll report that income and where the taxpayer individually will pay the tax. Martinez showed the taxpayer how much they owed the IRS and the California Franchise Tax Board, and had the taxpayer write checks payable to his bogus nominee bank accounts where he deposited these checks. Martinez then filed a different, fraudulent S-corporation return showing $1.5 million of income. So taxpayers saw an S-corp return with $12.2 million of income. What got filed to the IRS was $1.5 million. Also filed a fraudulent Form 1040 showing the taxpayer was full paid. And he did this over and over again until he had stolen over $11 million from his clients. Now, when the tax authorities received these understated taxable income returns, they didn't know. And his clients thought that he had filed the truthful returns and fully paid their liabilities on their behalf.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trusting this person and he says, sign here and I'll take care of filing this for you, how would they know?
Exactly.
They're under this impression that they've written the check gets cashed, and the IRS doesn't come calling. So these are some keys to this scheme working, right? Because if the IRS started sending notices at some point, then they might get curious and they might call and start to unravel this. And the way that you've described it, he not only embezzled money, but he committed tax evasion for his clients when he underreports their income. And then the procuring false tax returns charges come in because he's filing phony returns. And if you think about it, he's also committing identity theft because he's filing something using his client's identities.
Don't forget mail fraud. He did file those returns by mail.
Yep. Mail fraud too. Man, those charges really stack up. How did he get caught?
Well, he became aware in the summer of 2009 that he was under IRS investigation after one of his clients approached the IRS and said, I think my accountant is stealing my money.
Oof, oof. Yeah, I just get this pit in the bottom of my stomach thinking about that, what that must have felt like. And that's at the time then when he filed all of his own amended returns. So here he's trying to conceal the evasion.
Yeah, and it doesn't stop there. Around June 2009, he found out that the FBI had been investigating him. And he immediately started to rip off other people to pay off the victims of the initial fraud. He started to commit more fraud to cover up a previous fraud, almost like a fraud Ponzi scheme, I guess you could call it, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, he, along with his civil attorney, met with clients and confessed to stealing their money and offered them restitution.
No. So he stole and then put on a big show, acting contrite, asking forgiveness and repaying the money, but with the money he also stole from other people.
Absolutely, yes. That's what he was trying to do. But at this point, he had been doing this for so long, he was so confident about his ability to get caught, he thought he'd get away with it. But the thief's days are numbered. As the saying goes, every day for the thief, one day for the owner. Little did he know all of his dirty work was about to be discovered.
That's very apt. So guess when, this is my favorite part, guess when he finally gets arrested.
Yeah, I know, it's just so apropos. April 15th, our favorite date, 2011.
Man, can you believe it? Just to have your last day ever being a tax professional land on April 15th. I mean, the arresting team had to have a sense of humor in doing this, you know. No fanfare, no pizza party, just the click of the handcuffs and away you're taken. Do you think he ever got to clear out his e-file rejects?
I think he had a lot bigger fish to fry at that kid because the indictment was on 49 counts.
Whoa.
And by this time, the FBI had gathered more than enough incriminating evidence of all the fraud and other activities he had committed.
Yeah, let's talk about those charges because it really does stack up. It's like that domino effect. There's a few things here when we talk about how illegal income is reportable, and we kind of repeat it over in the business over and over again, but don't necessarily know where that comes from. So back in 1946, the Supreme Court decided in a case called Wilcox. And they actually determined that embezzled money was not taxable income to the embezzler.
Right.
Isn't that crazy? Because we always think of, no, you know, illegally gotten income actually needs to be reported. But the original precedenting case said, no, it's not taxable income. But here's what happened. It changed. And in 1952, we have another case in front of the Supreme Court, Rutkin, and reasserted the principle that an unlawful gain as well as lawfully obtained gains constitutes taxable income when its recipient has such control over it that, as a practical matter, the person derives readily realizable economic value from it. We have some other cases that come into play as well here, all in deciding when illegal income is taxable. In 1961, the Supreme Court addressed the interplay between the holdings of Rutkin and Wilcox. So they're kind of debating this, right? If you've got one case in favor of and one against you, now you bring that into the Supreme Court and they have to make an ultimate ruling, right? So that happened in 1961 in the James case. And in that case, it was a defendant that embezzled more than $738,000 from his employer. And of course, you know, didn't report the ill-gotten gains on his tax return. And so finally, in this case, the Supreme Court held that an embezzler subject to income tax the unlawful gains, period. You know, despite the fact that they don't have any title to such gains, you know, that was an argument that kind of came up before, like, hey, do they really have this kind of free and clear if, you know, it could be taken away at any point or seized, you know? So it's interesting arguments going back and forth. And it's an interesting history as well, because essentially the Supreme Court did not want to be involved in the injustice by relieving embezzlers of their duty to pay income taxes on the money that they enrich themselves with.
You know, this is a really interesting case law evolution, I should say, in the Supreme Court. You know, originally I teach a class on illegal income, so I know a little bit about this. They originally looked at embezzlement like, well, you have a debt you eventually have to repay. And because it's like that, it's not income, right? It's a liability that you've basically incurred with your theft. But then they reversed their original opinion and said, no, you know, first of all, there's no guarantee the embezzler will ever even pay the money back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that they have an unfettered right. They've taken the money. They have unfettered access to that money, even though there's a potential restitution. So it's income, right?
It's just a matter of time, right? So if you have one embezzler A that's able to spend down their $738,000 and you have embezzler B that chooses to save it.
Right.
You know, put it away for a rainy day, I guess. There's no difference in that. And I think what the Supreme Court ultimately wanted to do is say, hey, we have honest people that pay their taxes on every conceivable type of income. And it just wouldn't be fair that someone who has a lot and has access to exchange that for value of some kind, it would just wouldn't be fair.
And in 1950s is when the IRS issued its seminal decision in Glenshaw Glass on what is income, right? Which is an accession to wealth clearly realized over which the taxpayer has complete dominion. Those are the three-pronged test for what's income under the 16th Amendment. And so James comes after the Supreme Court established this more broader precedent of what is to be included in income for tax purposes.
Right. So they're getting much more specific and out of some of the ambiguity there to leave room for argument. Right. So let's talk about how that applies to this case. Stephen Martinez, he received unlawful gains. He did it because he committed fraud on his victims. and he gets more than $11 million from his clients, and he converts the proceeds of that fraud to his own personal use and benefit. So as an example, this man made home improvements in his home, including a $700,000 pool and a playground. He purchased a beach home in Mexico. He paid for the use of a private plane. He made payments associated with a boat, a motorhome, and a limousine. I mean, this guy was balling. He was living the life. And he also made investments. So he's a prudent embezzler. He embezzled over $2 million in other entities and paid over $2 million for his personal credit card and loans. You know, you want to be debt-free in this environment here. And Tom, he gave $40,000 in cash for safekeeping to his new limo driver, Norman. I want you to hear what Norman had to say about Stephen's house.
Okay.
I entered the little street, the little dirt road off the main road that goes up to his house. And there's a huge gate there. I was just intimidated, to be honest with you, by the size of the place. And then you drive in, and I'm just a huge driveway and this huge mansion. And I thought, this can't be where he lives. But no, that's what that was Steve's house.
Well, if he lived like that, he was bound to rack up a huge credit card bill. He also paid fees associated with one of his civil attorneys. Now, while checking the amended tax returns that he filed while under investigation for fraud in 2009, he failed to report almost $16 million in income, 15.8 to be precise. Now, experts say this amounts to about 20 years imprisonment on each of the wire fraud charges and up to 10 years on each of the money laundering charges. In addition to this, he's eligible to pay up to $14 million as restitution to the victims in court.
This is a little confusing because he stole close to $16 million. The restitution is at $14. And what's interesting about this, Tom, is that they went back and forth about restitution because remember, when he was suspecting that he was under investigation, he played the contrite, oh, boo-hoo, I'm so sorry, and gave some of the money back to the earlier victims. But that was with stolen money.
Right.
So his restitution actually kind of comes out lower than the amount he stole completely, right. And it's because of these bogus payments, you know? So he's arrested, we say April 15th. 4 days after he's arrested, he has his bond hearing. And the judge requested an appearance bond secured by real estate. And he posts the $350,000 bail by having two of his clients sign for his bond.
So, clients he stole from?
I don't know if he stole anything from these guys or not, but he approached one of his attorney clients in La Jolla. And that guy went home and talked to his wife about it. And his wife had the good sense to object to posting their home to secure the bond. So the attorney agreed instead just to act on the appearance bond. And I learned a lot about bonds from this case. I hadn't known much about getting bailed out, but I know a little bit more about it now. And you can have somebody vouch for you without securing the bond. In this case, they wanted a secure bond. So attorney says, hey, I'll vouch for you, but okay. I can't put my house up, right? My wife won't go for that.
So I don't know anything about these bonds, Dominique. Can you tell me a little bit more?
Yeah. So an appearance bond is a type of bail bond that's used in criminal proceedings, and it's a financial guarantee to the court that the defendant is going to show up for all of their scheduled court appearances. The defendant or someone on their behalf typically is going to pay a bondsman. And that fee that they pay is a non-refundable fee. And it's typically 10% of the total bond amount. And that's called posting bond. So if a defendant fails to appear in court as required, the bond is what's called forfeited, and the court may issue a warrant for the defendant's arrest. So in this case, Stephen Martinez has got a $350,000 bond. The bail bondsman can take a $35,000 payment, and then he can be released. But in this case, the judge specifically wants that bond secured by property.
Okay.
And so Steve hit up his old friend from the Mission Bay Athletic Club in San Diego, and this is a friend he'd known for 18 years. And it turns out that Stephen had helped pay for the friend's colon cancer surgery in 2005.
Oh, okay. So basically, the friend felt he might have died if it wasn't for Steve's financial help. So he's going to now put his house up to secure the bond.
You got it.
Wow. This guy has some friends. Friends he even stole from. It kind of makes you wonder who will show up for you in your time of need.
Yeah.
So now he's out on certain conditions. So it's not... He's just out first. He was restricted to San Diego County, California. This means he wasn't allowed to leave San Diego. He wasn't allowed to leave the country. He had active GPS monitoring. He had a curfew. He could not be out after 9 p.m. or before 5 a.m. He had to surrender his passport to the court. He had to have zero contact with victims or witnesses, and he immediately sought clarification on the people with whom he was to have no contact with. The court named some witnesses that he was prohibited to be in contact with.
So the court actually called them out by their names or just said victims of your crime?
Yes, and he agreed. They called them out by their name. Stephen Martinez said okay. He also surrendered his CPA license. Although he did remain a quote-unquote consultant, a quote-unquote bookkeeper, several people in an effort to support himself and his family, the court gave him permission to do so. And on April 21st, 2011, he was released from custody subject to the terms of the bond. Now, folks, pay attention. This is where it's about to get juicy.
Oh, I'm paying attention, all right.
All right, so apparently, unaware of all these conditions, which I find a little unbelievable, and the fact that Stephen may be away from his family, his brother, Greg Martinez, who lives in New York, purchased tickets for a Disney cruise for Stephen's family from January 8th to January 15th, 2022, the following year. Now, on December 13th, 2011, Stephen asked for permission from the court so he could accompany his family on that cruise.
Oh, please.
He also asked for relief from the curfew and GPS monitoring while he was on the cruise. Remember, he had a curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. The reason he wanted relief from the curfew is that he lives in Ramona, California, and he found it occasionally difficult to meet this requirement at the end of a business day. He said it also stopped him from family time. It made him unable to take his wife out for dinner on her birthday and their wedding anniversary. Sounds a bit suspicious to me. After all, this is in lieu of being in jail, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. But I'm more incensed by the nerve on this guy.
Right.
Didn't he also say he wanted the ankle monitor off because it prevented him from playing soccer with his kids?
He did. He said that the ankle bracelet prevented him from kicking the ball, and that's why he asked for the exception.
Yeah, man, it's crazy how he's using his family as an excuse. Huh, sounds like a stand-up guy. Oh, and also he said he can't play at the beach because of salt water. It would damage the ankle monitor. And he's effectively precluded from wearing shorts due to the embarrassment issues. You know, I have heard this from defendants, Tom, and I am just incensed. That is part of the point of the ankle monitor. And for a defendant to come into court and say, oh, this is embarrassing. Well, that's your consequence, dude.
Well, it's kind of embarrassing you would even come to court and try and make this argument, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's the consequence of committing fraud. And you would think maybe he would have thought about all these things before committing fraud. If he wanted to stay out past nine, maybe he shouldn't have taken other people's money.
Well, there's no way a judge would actually grant these requests, though. I mean, they aren't serious excuses.
Actually, after a plea from Steve's attorney, the judge considered. So here's the argument, and this just really, really grinds my gears. So apparently Steve's 8-year-old son is autistic, and the defense attorney argued that he was really looking forward to this trip. It was a reward for his positive behavior, and it would be too debilitating to take that trip away from the son.
Couldn't they just go to Disneyland? It's like an hour or 2 hours north of San Diego.
Yes, you would think. And actually, the AUSA argued the same thing. But because he was in full compliance with the conditions of his pretrial release, you know, the defendant is going to argue things like that, like, oh, he's been a good right. boy. The court went ahead and modified his conditions according to the law. So if he's not seen to pose a threat to the conditions of his bond or to his community, the curfew restrictions, the limitations, you know, operating motor vehicles, travel and communication, that can be authorized. He was supposedly so grateful to the court for releasing him on bond, and he had done everything in his power to demonstrate to the court that this placed trust in him was not misplaced trust. In fact, in his utmost respect for the court, he instructed his lawyers to not seek permission from the court to return back east for his mother's burial, which took place on the 27th of May, 2011. So he's saying, hey, I respect you so much. I didn't even ask you to let me out of these restrictions to go to my mom's funeral.
So, wait a minute. So with the blessing of this court, of this judge, he gets his passport, is permitted to travel internationally, and enjoy a Disney cruise while under indictment for stealing millions of dollars from people who had placed their trust in him? Are you serious? Well, this is where things actually go from bad to worse, if you can believe it, on a gigantic scale.
He fled.
Not quite, although I have to wonder why he didn't, because what he did do was worse.
But that's going to have to wait until next time, Tom. We just couldn't tell the whole story in just one episode. So be sure to join us next time for the riveting conclusion to this case. It includes betrayal in massive proportions, more theft, a limo, and murder.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Tax Crime Junkies. Remember, as we uncover the stories of tax fraud and white-collar crime, we're not just exposing the criminals, but also the loopholes in the system. We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left open and close them for good. Until next time, remember that every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Tax Crime Junkies. If you would like to share what you think about the case, you can contact us at taxcrimejunkies.com. Also, remember to subscribe to get notified when we are back with our next episode. And if you loved this one, please jump on Apple or Google Play to give us a positive rating. Have a great day.